Thanks for listening to Bookworm. I'm host Michael Silverblatt. If there's another podcast that comes from us at KCRW that I really like, is The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. I've said it for a long time. Elvis's style of interviewing is like jazz. He orchestrates so many interesting moments and gets people to say such surprising and interesting things about film, about popular culture. He really knows his subject, and he's one of the very best in the country. Listen to The Treatment.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have as my guests David Shields and Caleb Powell, who have collaborated on a quarrel. The quarrel is called I Think You're Totally Wrong. What I like about this book is that the two of them, once upon a time teacher and student, now 20 years later, are going through the problems that people have in talking about anything, it seems to me, in culture. The cultural essence is disagreement and the acceptance that we don't come to conclusions, that we will disagree and assert our right to disagree from the deepest parts of our heart. Now tell me, 20 years ago, you were his teacher. What led you to approach Caleb?
Caleb was my student 25 years ago. He was a very disagreeable student who loved to argue with me. About sort of 15 years later, Caleb came to a reading of mine. Then later, I refused to give a blurb to a book of Caleb's that I liked okay, but not enough to give a blurb to. Caleb wrote a mixed interview and review of my book, Reality Hunger. I wanted to write a book in which I argued against myself through someone else. I tried a couple of other people whom I disagreed with so strongly that I couldn't even argue with them. I tried Caleb, and our gears engaged immediately. There's something about, as Caleb says really beautifully, we have a natural reverse dynamic. We can't even agree on what time it is. And so Caleb and I, when was it, Caleb, 3 years ago?
It was in November of 2010 when you first broached the subject.
And
so
we
it was over 4 years ago, and then it was 3 years ago in the fall
that we actually did it.
Of 2011 that we did the project.
The essential debate to me, and I've probably have said this too many times, but Caleb is someone who always wanted to become an artist, who overcommitted to life. He's a stay-at-home dad to three young girls. And I always wanted to become a human being, but I overcommitted to art. I tried to convince Caleb the way that one has to completely commit to art in order to make it. And Caleb powerfully points out how extraordinarily limited such a possibility can be.
Now, Caleb, you thought he hated you. Why?
Well, at least disliked me or didn't appreciate or engage with my opinions back in the classroom because he was very condescending to some of my writing. Now, my first class that I took with him, I was Christian, and I wrote a book glorifying Christianity. And he, in a philosophical context, and he, one of his comments that he said in class is that we're all smarter than this. And we don't have time for this.
Wow.
And so, what did I say, that we're all smarter than religion or something?
Or my writing or both. But anyway, that was one of his statements. It was very dismissive, and I was kind of surprised that on campus about two and a half years later when he bumped into me, and I had just had a story published in the University of Washington's newspaper that he had read it and said, hey, you know, if you're still writing, I'm teaching a fiction class. So, yeah, because I thought I was the sort of student that he would not want in a class of his.
Now, do either of you still believe in fiction?
I would.
I I do. We'll let David, you know, David's already kind of spread out his ideas to the world, but...
I mean, I would sort of dismantle the question. I think it's a problematic way to even ask the question, Michael, in the sense that, you know, I love novels from, you know, Tristram Shandy to Ben Lerner's Leaving Theotosia Station. The question is, how do we make a work of narrative art now that feels congruent with contemporary life? It probably, almost certainly, looks nothing like the traditional novel. So to me, the moment you say, do either of you still believe in fiction, I'd rephrase the question, how does a contemporary writer create a work of narrative art that has the compression, concision, and velocity of contemporary life? Then we can talk about what books look like contemporary life.
Recently, I had David read a review of mine by Tao Lin. My review reviewed Tao Lin's Richard Yates. It was published in a Canadian online journal. And he had his basic, it's almost like his default mechanism is he's arguing from his premise of what a 20th century novel is because he criticized my critique as arguing for the 20th century novel. And by his definition, he's right. But what is a traditional novel or a contemporary novel or fiction? And that's where I disagree. I mean, we have nonfiction, then we have taking those liberties, and then we have, if you're going to take so many liberties that no longer is nonfiction, what's next? Fiction, literature. And a lot of literature does have that incredibly thin barrier, but you can still make the narrative more readable. I mean, if you want to be concise, if you want velocity, you can do that. But it doesn't, there's a universal novel that's just good writing that will continue forever. And people will, I mean, there's one thing if you're just completely making up a story, and there's another fictional novel that parallels your life almost exact, but you're calling it fiction.
Oh, well,
and that's what literature
is. First of all, do you like Tao Lin?
You know, I found the novel Richard Yates almost unreadable. I read it to the finish. It was sort of my revenge of reading it to the finish. But I liked some of his very early stuff, but basically no.
I've had him on the show a couple of times. I'm a rather a fan, and one of the things that I find wonderful about him is that he doesn't know what to say, and when he doesn't know what to say, he says nothing.
On the show.
On the show.
I love that.
He doesn't pretend that he has an answer for things that can't be answered.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me kind of excited. And then his last book, Taipei, I thought was really a break into, like breaking a lock in a safe, in a bank, a break into life. You know, it was very, very exciting to me.
All right, fair enough.
I'm curious because among the things that happen in the adventure of David Shields is that all sorts of people, well, looking just at the back jacket of this, Jonathan Rabin, Susan Deitch, Peter Brooks, all sorts of people, but I thought with great surprise when in Reality Hunger you had a quote from Charles Baxter, people who write the kind of fiction that you're objecting to are waving a banner in your favor, almost as if to say, what a relief. The terms of the argument are changing. We need a new way of approaching this material.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's right or not, the old ways have grown stagnant. Now, are you at war against stagnation?
I'm against boredom. I don't want to endlessly.
Well, who's for boredom?
I think of this book that we did, I Think You're Totally Wrong, A Quarrel, as an attempt to move beyond stagnation. I've gone through various phases of my life. I wrote three novels. I did some sports writing. I've written some book-length essays. I've done some literary collage. I've done some literary criticism. And so right now, this book came out of the idea that I wanted to throw a hand grenade into the foxhole in which I was hiding. And that hand grenade came out in the form of Caleb Powell, for which I'm eternally grateful.
Hmm. Now tell me what you mean by a hand grenade.
Well, I mean, Caleb and I, as I tried to say earlier, we have a funny reverse dynamic. And to me, Caleb was a wonderful, walking, visceral, primal, argumentative embodiment of the opposition.
Caleb, what is the opposite position?
The way that we approach secrets and exposing our inner selves and our egos, I think we have two very different views of how we should do that, and I'm going to be specific here. As far as taking risk, which I've accused David of not doing.
Which is ludicrous. I mean, well, I'm going Caleb's to come up idea here. Of secrets is to say that he received fellatio from some prostitute in Thailand,
well,
whereas I actually talk
would,
about—
Once they find that out, they wouldn't want people knowing
I know,
about
whereas
that.
I convey an intimate secret of my internal life regarding my
well,
marriage
I'm
or my childhood.
Well, I'm going to get you right here. Just give me, let me speak here and bring it out, bring it on, in other words. About a year and a half ago, I uploaded a YouTube video of David on a riding lawnmower, publicly showing him to be kind of a human, happy guy. And I got a phone call from an extremely irate David, throwing a few F-bombs, asking me what I'm doing. And I said, what's the big deal? And he said, we're trying to get a movie with Franco, and I got this text from Franco, and
James Franco here,
yeah.
Who's done a film of I Think You're Totally
well,
Wrong, the book that we're talking about by my guests,
correct.
David Shields and Caleb Powell.
In the book, we agree at the end to not reveal certain secrets. And we both did reveal secrets. When he talks about his exposing and being naked, he had some pretty good secrets. And at the university bookstore in our first talk, when I brought this up, he said, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? What he did in the film, revealing some of my secrets, which are very subtle, but I am going to get some questions. And I did take some offense to that. And I felt my certain confidentialities had, been brought out.
The book is very interesting in that it, to my mind, demonstrated our need to have impossible arguments about racism, about politics, about opinions that cannot be settled. But because they can't be settled, people have gotten used to not talking. In the anticipation of an argument that will not end, and that, or if it has an end, will end friendships. So people don't talk anymore, and the book is a demonstration, often shocking, of how far people need to go in order to get back human life and human interchange. I found it very moving.
That's nice, Michael. Thank you. I mean, that's really lovely.
Yeah, thanks.
I recently read this beautiful essay about Heart of Darkness, in which the critic Paul Armstrong is talking about how all of Conrad is, can we understand the other? And even though Caleb and I aren't that different, we're, two bald, middle-aged white guys who live in and around Seattle, we're not that different, but we are unbelievably different human beings. And to me, what I like about the book and film is, even though we have, as is demonstrated by us on the radio continuing to argue, we have a vexed, problematic relationship. But, Caleb is trying to learn how to empathize with me, and I'm trying to learn how to empathize with him. And, it's sort of the anti, however you want to say it, sort of Fox News debate in which all you do is dig into your entrenched positions. Can we ever truly understand another human being is the question of, to me, all of my work. And in this book, in this film, even in this book tour, I'm trying to really understand Caleb, who drives me absolutely crazy. I drive him crazy.
David Shields has unleashed a screed against a certain kind of formulaic fiction.
Right.
Fiction that's
it's not a screed, but anyway.
By now. I'm sorry. I'm speaking off the cuff.
Sure.
But yeah, no, a carefully structured.
That's what you meant to say, Michael.
And,
yes,
and
exactly.
And the fiction he doesn't like and the reasons why he doesn't like it, I can agree with.
Okay. And... and central to the idea of that kind of fiction is the revelation of secrets. It's kind of a tiresome move on the part of that kind of novel that now, having trudged through so much exposition, we have the tepid revelation of a secret, as if a secret mattered.
Exactly.
As if a secret ever mattered, really. That somehow in our lives, in our hour of need, if you'll pardon me, we have to get over the idea of secrets and scandals because there are so many of them by now that unless we get to the bottom of them, we're never going to live in anything like an honest society.
Right.
That's lovely, Michael. That's really beautifully
said. I
agree.
And sometimes the secrets are ho-hum or everyone has them.
And so what?
So what's your larger, like, okay, that's a really lovely kind of Roland Barthesian take on the hermeneutic coding of secrets that we've
I was hoping to avoid the hermeneutic coding of
but,
secrets.
But I mean, if once that you've read Barthes, it's very hard to go back and say, oh my God, isn't this a beautifully patterned novel? How many patterned novels do we need to read? But where did you want to take that, Michael? And they're like, okay, I think you're right. That Caleb and I, like, for me, I want the careful curating and deconstructing of the whole idea of secrets, whereas I think Caleb still believes in sort of capital S secrets, perhaps.
Well, one second. This is not a secret. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with David Shields and Caleb Powell about their new book, I Think You're Totally Wrong. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Shields and Caleb Powell about their new book, I Think You're Totally Wrong, where former teacher and student debate the big question, life or art. But really what I'm finding is that it's exciting to jump in the pool, that as long as I stay as an outsider, as a commentator, there won't be excitement here. It won't be alive. What they do is bring life back to the idea of conversation by turning it into quarrel and by turning every quarrel into an argument. What is the value of argument? Remind me.
I think, like any criticism, you have to be able to take it. You have to see if it's right or not. And if you agree with it, you're going to change and adapt and improve. And if you disagree with it, you'll have a better reason for believing what you continue to believe.
I mean, again, I'm sounding rather literary here and professorial, but, you know, the Mikhail Bakhtin idea of, you know, the multiplicity and polyphony of narrative art, different points of view. And to me, our book nicely embodies that idea that my wife, who generally doesn't like my work very much at all, loves this book. That she loves this book. And she
That's because she met me.
Yes, exactly. She has a crazy crush on Caleb now. But not true, of course. But anyways, the point being that that she said in this really concise way, she goes, it won't work if it were just you. It won't work if it were just Caleb. It works only because your two points of view are completely contradictory and completely cancel each other out. You're not right. Caleb's not right. The answer lies in the spaces in between you. And that's the beautiful dialectic of the book, in my view.
You've mentioned Bakhtin and Roland Barthes. And we all giggled at the arrival of the inevitable word hermeneutics. I would say, among other things, that vocabulary of that sort became the jargon of not the artist but the intellectual. I remember Robert Creeley hearing talk like that around the University of Buffalo, where Heidegger was getting his more than due. Robert Creeley would say, "Yeah, man, dig." Right, he was tired of it as soon as it came up. And why do you think that Bakhtin and Barth have any more continuing to this moment validity than an 18th century novel? What keeps these ideas alive for you? Why do you quote them?
Great question. I think for some reason I think of yet another French writer, Robe Grier, you know, whose notes toward the end of a novel captures for me, you know, as I seem to like to say, you know, I wrote three novels, I got bored with them, and people like Roland Barthes and Robe Grier articulate powerfully for me why the novel form went empty for me. Not that I've become a critic per se, I become, I hope, an essayist. And Barthes' critique of the novel and Robe Grier's critique of the novel articulate for me the often formulaic nature of contemporary novels and help me find a way into a form such as this book. That, you know, I just love this line of Walter Benjamin, who said, "All great works of literature either dissolve a genre or invent one."
Don't round up Benjamin. The inevitable suspects.
So
Walter
what?
Benjamin arrives on the scene.
Walter
Benjamin just showed up.
It turns it into the cliched conversation of the current academy.
Well,
Roland Barthes, Bakhtin, Benjamin. What's coming next? I mean, you know,
Silverblatt, Shields, and Powell. I mean, all great works of literature dissolve a genre or invent one.
What's
a more exciting idea than that? I want works of literature that push art forward rather than, yeah, man, dig. That takes us to really deep places as well.
Well, what I think Creeley was up to was to say, you guys think you're poets, you're not poets. You guys think you're philosophers, you're not philosophers. Heidegger was a philosopher. Who do you think you are?
You don't think that Roland Barthes is a better writer than Robert Creeley? There's no comparison.
Roland Barthes is an expository writer, and Creeley is a poet, and Creeley's poetry is better than Barthes' attempt at impressionistic autobiography.
SZ has a greater purchase on my mind and heart than any poem of Robert Creeley.
But that tells us who you are, not who Barthes and Creeley are.
Roland Barthes has a deeper purchase on the culture than Robert Creeley does. He's a much more exciting, thoughtful, and feelingful writer.
But I don't think that the range of emotion that you find in poetry is similar to the range of thoughtfulness that you find in Roland Barthes.
Well, I think you're making, in my view, Michael, a false distinction between there's this very puristic empyrean realm over here called poetry, and over here this rather boring and pedantic academic discourse called philosophy or criticism. It's like Caleb always calls me something called a literary critic. It would be like, because occasionally I write about literature as part of a larger investigation. I think it's just a really false dichotomy.
It's accurate.
Over here is poetry and over here is philosophy.
You've been, you know, basically instructing with all your, you know, Walter Benjamin, or however I, you know, butcher the pronunciation. You are continually instructing, you're bringing up all the books you've read. It's tough for you to go, you know, 2-3 minutes without mentioning some book you read or some author, which I'm the sort of curious guy that I'm going to look these quotes up if I haven't read them, but of course with you, I've heard them all. But at the same time, you're not speaking a common language, a more accessible language. And I think that relates to your being a literary critic and not having this connection with people who...
You calling me a literary critic is like me calling you a war criminal, in the sense that you're really interested...
False analogy.
You're really interested in war, so I'll call you a war criminal. I'm really interested in literature, so you call me a literary critic. I've written 20 books, some of which deal with literature. So what?
The qualities of Creeley and Barth, as far as who... You were basically criticizing them.
No. But David, let me put it this way. David and I are speaking about these two figures as lovers.
Exactly.
The question
lovers
is,
appreciate them.
Who loves who more?
Right, right.
Is always a question anywhere in a relationship or in a family.
Right.
Who loves who more? That becomes the subject, in a certain essence, of this book and
right.
of the film.
Right.
Do we love one another? When we argue, do we hate one another? What is the nature of the argument? Is it a lover's argument or is it a ferocious hater's argument?
It's complicated. Right. There's one thing to say is that it's an ancient form, Michael. Plato and Socrates, Goethe and Eckermann, Cartalk, Didi and Gogo, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Laurel and Hardy. My God, there's this ancient form of two guys arguing, two people arguing for their philosophical lives. And that, to me, Caleb and I are trying to extend the form by making it, to me, as naked as it's ever been, as visceral, as raw.
What is here is that the conversation becomes endless and exciting again. No matter what happens, you think of something else that needs to be said, so it can't end.
That's
it
beautiful.
It can't end. Isn't that great?
The comedy of irresolution.
The comedy
really
of constant re-resolution.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Cut, print, don't you think?
I think so.
Cue the piano.
I've been talking with David Shields and Caleb Powell, authors of I Think You're Totally Wrong, published by Knopf. The film, based upon this work, this quarrel, will be coming out in just...
We found out we're premiering in Vancouver for the Doxa Documentary Film Festival.
In April.
April, May, yeah.
And then it will be making its way around the world, yes?
We hope so.
It'll
really pretty much sweep the Oscars this year, I think.
Thank you both for joining me. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. It's been very interesting and a pleasure.
It's called I Think You're Totally Wrong, published by Knopf. Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer, Connie Alvarez, Alan Howard, associate producer, the technical director, Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Chang-Rae Lee is our guest.